everybody. We're back again with another OneLiner.com podcast. I am Craig, and as always with me are Scott.
A very good evening to you.
And the man that some people can only bring themselves to call Drew.
Indeed, there are those who would call me Drew. Hello.
Drew wears black and sits in a black corner. Ram Jam with top movie delights for you, as always, so we shan't waste any further time and we will crack on. Rise of the Planet of the Apes, then. Is it a reboot? Is it a prequel? If so, to the original films or to Tim Burton's much maligned remake? Who knows? Rise, not to be confused with any Saturday morning television shows, stars James Franco as Will Rodman, a scientist with designs on eliminating Alzheimer's, which is a worthy enough goal. When testing on chimps produces an uber-smart offspring in the form of Andy Serkis mo-capped Caesar. Just imagine if it just produced Andy Serkis. Things naturally snowball into a simian uprising of the next level variety. Now, photoreal CGI monkeys have long been my ultimate dream, Scott. Is it realised here?
They're certainly the best CG monkeys I've seen. It's much better than King Kong.
Fair enough. But that's all I need to know.
There's an awful lot of films that are much, much better than King Kong.
Indeed.
Everyone seems quite sensibly to have forgotten about Tim Burton's ill-advised reboot somewhat 10 years ago, which is probably the best course of action, as it was one of the few films substantially worse than King Kong. You can't keep a good ape down, and let's say, as you mentioned, what exactly this is, I don't know. Is it a reboot? Is it a remake? Is it a prequel? Is it a pre-boot? That's what I'm going to call it, a pre-boot. In terms of the actual plot, there's not an awful lot more than what you've just said there.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that monkeys equal fun. But what about smart monkeys, boys? What about smart monkeys? Super smart monkeys with agendas.
Super smart, you say?
With agendas, Craig. With agendas and red jumpers. Are those fun?
Tell me more.
Well, no. Turns out that those sort of monkeys are less fun and more terrifying, violent and destructive. Turns out those sort of monkeys equals death. And before anyone writes in to complain, I'm well aware of the differences between monkeys and apes, but monkey's a better word with more comedic connotations, so kindly keep your complaints to yourself. This is a considerably smarter entry into the Planet of the Apes canon than Tim Burton's effort from 2001, even if its themes of humans bringing about their own downfall due to tinkering recklessly with nature are hardly groundbreaking. Inconsistencies in the main characters, though, undermine their actions and their appeal. When James Franco's Will tries to persuade his one-dimensional, money-obsessed boss David Oyelowo that proper small-scale testing must be done first on the improved intelligence-increasing serum he's developed, his protestations are ignored, and it's this accelerated production of the new compound that enables the eventual rise of the apes and the rebellion. However, I think we might feel a little more compelled to sympathise with Will as an unwitting victim of the consequences of his research if, at the beginning of the film, he hadn't himself declared the serum ready for mass production when, after 6 years of waiting, he gets one positive result on a test subject. Scientific rigour is not one of the film's traits. It is, however, reasonably entertaining. The CGI is impressive, though we're not yet at the stage where you're in any doubt if the ape you're seeing is real or computer-generated. And this impressive CGI, coupled with Andy Serkis's expectedly but still impressively nuanced performance capture, means that the main monkey, Caesar, is a compelling, fairly fully realised character. The other problems are, though, that there are far too many references to the original 1968 Planet of the Apes, including a desperately shoehorned in Damn Dirty Ape quotation delivered by Tom Felton. But those things aside, it's a decent enough watch. It's reasonably entertaining for the most part, and I would say particularly so if your tolerance for the last act, when the film becomes nothing more than a CGI showreel, is greater than mine. Up to the point it just descended into computerised things hitting other computerised things on a big computer bridge, I was quite enjoying it, so it's not a bad film at all.
Succinct, Scott.
It's perfectly acceptable for the summer season films. It's probably more intelligent than you'd expect for something that is a tentpole movie. There's a few more interesting themes in here than many of its compadres. There's some pretty good performances. Franco is pretty good. Certainly holds the intention well. John Lithgow, well, I'm not sure if John Lithgow is one of these difficult roles or it's one of these sort of, you know, Alzheimer's is always a bit of a, it's kind of like easy sympathy to go for, oh, he's got Alzheimer's and he's acting kind of quirky and now he's better. I don't know if that was that's a bit cynical or not, but it's a perfectly acceptable performance.
Yeah, I would say for the most part, the only bit that bothered me, and I actually think it may just simply be John Lithgow's face. Or perhaps having...
I was basically bothered by John Lithgow's face.
I am going to qualify. This isn't just immediate dislike from anything. Like John Lithgow. It may be that, or it may just be seeing him in far too many episodes of Third Rock from the Sun, but in one scene where he's confused due to his Alzheimer's and is trying to drive his neighbour's car.
That sketch.
It felt kind of like a real sort of sitcom-y sequence to me, and his face just seemed kind of goonish. But beyond that, yeah, he's not given a lot to do, and it's kind of hard to both be pretending to suffer from Alzheimer's while at the same time pretending to interact with a monkey that's going to be added in by some man on the computer later on.
I can't watch John Lithgow in anything without thinking of A, Raising Kane, and also the bit at the end of Cliffhanger where he has to actually look out the window of the helicopter to realise it's falling down a cliff.
I don't remember that for so long since I've seen Cliffhanger. It's not etched in my memory, unfortunately, but it's them.
Did you do a double take and go, oh no!
Oh dear! Suboptimal gravitational situation! Why he suddenly turned quite a Scottish.
It's probably something to do with his face.
Yeah. It's his face. John Lithgow's face. Look what it's done to Libya. That man doesn't realise the power his face wields.
I didn't realise my face's own strength. You can pick flaws with a scientific rigour. I would also wonder why there's an ape sanctuary run by people that hate apes. It seems that if you had a dislike for apes,
Draco Malfoy,
you just wouldn't get into the ape handling business.
Yeah, I'd forgotten to right now quite what I remembered that is reminding me of. It's like something from 101 Dalmatians or something. Yeah, there's some sort of animal pound that exists just to service the needs of the evil person in charge of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Brian Cox may as well have been playing Cruella de Vil.
But, God, I mean, you could pick flaws in the plot all day. It's not really the sort of film that you go for 100% scientific accuracy, given that it's about intelligent monkeys. It's a perfectly good yarn. It's certainly much better than the last attempt at the Planet of the Apes saga, and it's a very worthy entry in the franchise. It's certainly much better than most of the other films that were in there. And if it does produce sequels, as it certainly hints at, I don't know if they're actually going to be made or not, but it would deserve to have at least one other entry in the series so we can see what happens next. It's perfectly entertaining movie. Hardly something that you need to beat down doors to go and see, but it is pretty decent filmmaking for the summer season.
You have to imagine there's going to be more, aren't they? Because it's performed so well, and the studios aren't making anything without a view to it possibly becoming a franchise these days.
It does seem sort of tailor-made to have a sequel, and actually it wouldn't feel gratuitous in this case, because the sequel is sort of ready there, waiting to be told of how the monkeys might take over. And if it can be handled as well as this, it's not particularly a bad idea that there should be a sequel.
Mm.
It's perfectly competent, reasonably enjoyable summertime viewing, as Scott said.
Yeah, it's one of only three films that I've actually had much interest in this year, to be honest with you, and I haven't had a chance to catch up with it, so I'll have to wait until I'll have to wait for the DVD now, I guess. But yeah, I suppose everybody else that I know who's seen it says it's very good, so I shall defer to their judgment. Check it out. You know you want to. On to Cowboys and Aliens now. Graphic novels are running out of steam even more quickly than movies based on graphic novels are running out of steam. That's why I have no intention of ever watching something so stupidly conceived as Cowboys and Aliens. Scott, do your thing.
It's very much from the Snakes on a Plane playbook, isn't it? Wouldn't it be cool if there was snakes on a plane? Yes, let's make a film. Wouldn't it be cool if there was cowboys versus aliens? Yes, let's make a film. Yes.
Let's throw it out there and see if it works.
That said, I did find Cowboys and Aliens surprisingly enjoyable, given the kind of lukewarm reception it has had. For about the first half hour or so, aside from the odd flash here or there, it's not much different from a standard Western setup. You have Daniel Craig's mysterious stranger wandering into town with an unknown past. There's a small town with under the thumb of a cattle baron, who's also the sort of ex-general with a slightly mysterious past. The lawmen are kind of well under his thumb, and said cattle baron, in this case Harrison Ford's son, played by Paul Dano's getting himself into trouble, going around drinking and making a nuisance of himself generally. The mysterious stranger gets into a collision course with these and sort of looks to be defending himself and the locals and so on. And that's probably relatively familiar to anyone that's got any rough experience of the Western genre. It's a kind of a standard staple setup for it. And actually, it's handled pretty well. And it's the sort of thing where I was watching it going, I would quite like to see this cast, you know, just go off and do a serious Western in the genre, a serious entry. It's quite well handled. And then after about half an hour, an alien battleship shows up and destroys the fuck out of everything. And then it takes on a very different tone after that. Said alien warship takes off many of the townsfolk and makes an ungodly mess of everything in the process. And the mysterious stranger tries to uncover his past, which is obviously intertwined with the aliens, and joins forces with Harrison Ford's Woodrow Dollarhide to go off and try and get his people back. If you're going to be massively reductive and harsh on the film, then it's not going to be anything more than a footnote in anyone involved's career. The bulk of the supporting cast and the leads and the director have all been responsible for far more iconic works or characters. For example, Ford's Dollarhide is not going to be mentioned in the same breath as Richard Kimball or Han Solo or Indiana Jones. Daniel Craig's Jake Lonergan isn't James Bond. This film isn't Iron Man. There's just no defining moment in big budget tentpole cinema. However, if you were going into big budget tentpole cinema expecting to find instant classics, you're going to be disappointed approximately 99.9% of the time. Best you can expect for something that's relatively entertaining for your cash, and for my money at least, Cowboys and Aliens was. I probably enjoyed it more than any of the other big summer blockbuster type things of the kind of more action-oriented stuff. I think it actually hangs together better. It's better handled and it's certainly better acted, and the characters are somewhat more interesting. The ridiculousness of the setup is just about enough to kind of get you over it. If you can stomach the concept of going in to see a film with this conceit, And you can get over enough of that to actually pay money to go and see it, then you will, I think, like the rest of it. Right, if you're going in here looking for drama, obviously, no. If you want something that's cohesive, no. Cowboys and aliens are the two genres. Science fiction and Western just don't seem to mix particularly well in this instance. I can't think of too many that have, apart from possibly Westworld, which is possibly the only crossover.
Boy, have we got a vacation for you.
Cowboys and Aliens is, for the most part, absolutely acceptable. It's far more lighthearted than Rise of the Planet of the Apes, so in terms of just vacuous popcorn entertainment, it's a better candidate than that. It's not a better film. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a far more cohesive and has far better internal logic than there are cowboys, there are aliens, they fight, which is slender. And I'm being quite charitable to it. I'm trying to be quite a nice person lately. But yeah, regardless of that, you will not remember much of it next year. You will not remember much of it next month. You'll probably remember watching it, and you'll probably remember it being relatively enjoyable, and that's what it is. It's not much more than that. It's, I think, worthy of a look if you can stomach the general overarching conceit. If you can get past that, I think you'll find a decent level of enjoyment in there. If not, then obviously don't.
On to the guard. When Brendan Gleeson's Irish police sergeant Jerry Boyle isn't busy pouring scorn and apathy on his subjects, he's often to be found popping tabs of LSD found in the pockets of young car accident victims. Imagine his disdain then when big shot FBI agent Wendell Everett, Don Cheadle to you and I, turns up on Irish shores to warn of an imminent big league cocaine shipment destined for Boyle's jurisdiction. Writer-director John Michael McDonagh, brother of In Bruges writer-director Martin, has made entertaining viewing of a slight script that prefers dialogue over action, and while it may not be the deepest of works, if a brotherly arms race were to ensue, the results will no doubt prove rather entertaining, Scott.
Yeah, so as you say, there is almost nothing to The Guard.
Oh.
What happens is Don Cheadle shows up and they have a mismatched buddy comedy for a half an hour or so, and for most of that time, Brendan Gleeson is actually not with Don Cheadle, he's off with two tarts and he's pretending to be a pimp.
it's not even a mismatched buddy, it's just one guy being completely offensive and the other just being exasperated.
Yeah, I believe that the John Michael McDonagh is Irish, because if not, this is remarkably racist. it happily plays to stereotype. I don't know why Don Cheadle is in this film. I've nothing against Don Cheadle, but the character that he plays here might as well be a balloon with a face painted on it. You know, nothing against him. He's just given nothing to do other than act shocked as Brendan Gleeson's Sergeant Jerry Boyle comes out with some of the most remarkable shit.
It's truly remarkable.
So nominally, when Everett and Boyle are trying to track down a drug shipment coming in, I did like the scene where he picks flaws in the street value estimation, which is a running annoyance of mine, so I was glad someone else has it. A drug shipment holed up by Mark Strong and his Irish compadres, who are a couple of dodgy characters and deals with the corruption in the police department, but the plot of it all is almost entirely irrelevant. Essentially, it's just Brendan Gleeson going about making some tremendously off-colour statements about pretty much everything he comes across. And in a sort of reductive sense, obviously that shouldn't work, but it does. It's pretty damn funny, based entirely on Brendan Gleeson. I think if you had put almost anyone else in this role, it would have been a disaster. But he delivers his lines with aplomb, some perfectly pitched lines, and it's very well done. It's pretty close to the bone. It's probably not one for the... If you're sensitive about anything to do with race or...
I wouldn't watch it if I were Bill Cosby.
No.
You were saying you weren't sure whether he was Irish or not. He's actually a Londoner, but appears to be of Irish descent and spent a lot of time in his childhood in Ireland. I guess that gets him a pass just, but he's on a bit of shaky ground there, I think.
It's one of those films that it's a clothes horse to hang some daft dialogue on, isn't it? Mm. It's primarily about the dialogue and about some random characters. And, I mean, it's what, just shy of 90 minutes long or something? Fairly zips by, and it's got absolutely no substance, but the fact that it felt like it was gone in 60 seconds tells me that it was probably worthwhile watching. It's certainly done at the Irish box office. It did enough money at the Northern Irish box office to propel it to something like number 6 in the overall UK chart before it was released over here on the mainland, so that should tell you something about how the Irish embraced it. What that says about the Irish, I don't know. But, yeah, it's certainly got a couple of faces you wouldn't expect to find in it. Mark Strong stars in another of the films we'll be looking at this week, but Mark Strong's quickly become one of my favourite actors, and it's a pleasure for him to pop up in this, although I have to be said that the character that he plays, one of the three sort of bad guys for me, was the one thing that doesn't work so well. That descended into that sort of... It's almost become a cliche now where you have sort of these bad guys who are vicious killers just sort of hanging around, doing nothing for most of the time, but having sort of existential conversations about stuff. And that's supposed to be funny in and of itself, but unfortunately that's been done too many times now. That was probably the only thing that disappointed me. But yeah, if you're looking for some sort of deep and meaningful comment on what it means to be rural Irish, then unfortunately you've bought a ticket to the wrong film. But if you're knocking about town and you're next to the cinema and you've got a couple of hours free, or if you fancy watching a film one night and you go down to the, you know, Blockbuster or whatever and you're not entirely sure what to rent, or if you're browsing through your sort of your online rentals and things like that and this pops up, it's definitely worth a couple of quid of your money to check it out. It's a funny little number.
It is very funny. It's very slender, though, and for a film that was the Edinburgh Film Festival kind of hung itself on, it seems a very strange choice. There is nothing at all to this film apart from a couple of relatively well-known actors.
Yeah, Don Cheadle got a holiday out of it.
Had a tour of Ireland.
Yeah. But, man, you know, if every time Don Cheadle takes a holiday it's this entertaining, then, you know, good on him.
Yeah, for all its slightness, for all its slenderness, for all its outright racism, there's not... I can't remember too many films that I've seen this year that I've found funnier, so...
No, exactly.
Yeah, give it a bash.
Can't have been too bad. Now, Jason Momoa is a charismatic son of a bitch. I know that because I've watched some press junket fluff pieces for the Conan remake, of which said slab of beef plays the lead. I can't imagine that such a personality smart bomb as Momoa could possibly turn out a performance as effective as a walking carpet sample with a sword. Could he? Who had notes on Conan?
Nobody
has notes on Conan. Which way is this one going?
There was some bloke, what you just mentioned, Craig.
Yeah.
And he's there, and he has a sword, and there's some sword fights, and I got a headache, and it ended.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I just want to point out that I've never actually... I must be about the only guy in his late 20s or early 30s. I'd love to think of myself as late 20s, but no, I'm early 30s. Who hasn't seen the original Conan the Barbarian. So I've no frame of reference here. Scott, am I glad that I haven't seen the remake?
I'll give it this. It was a much louder film than the original, although that may just be...
I think that was just the
cinema, yeah.
It was painfully loud.
Yeah, but once I mopped up the blood from my ear canals, you know, you can't fault Conan the Barbarian for going directly after the target audience. It's packed, full of action, It's remarkably stupid. And if you... And it appears to be exactly what you'd want from what I understand Conan to be. If you've not seen the original Conan, apparently, from some reading around what I have just done, it's not actually a particularly good representation of the character that you're... The Conan character. Mm. Arnold Schwarzenegger's take on Conan is someone that grows about, grunts occasionally, hits someone with swords, and is generally miserable. And in that respect, this Conan is somewhat more accurate. He has a bit more charisma to him. He is the charisma smart bomb, as you so put it.
So through all of that film, the word charisma didn't once come into my head.
I've no particular grudge against Momoa, but the character has very little to do other than swing a sword and go, ah ha, I've swung a sword. And there's lots of kind of... looking at the sky and going, no, or rar, or or something like that.
So it might as well just be a film of a guy walking down the street, kicking a stone and laughing at it. Ha ha ha, kicked a stone.
Don't knock it. Everybody needs a hobby.
What I would say is the original film did feel a lot more, the Schwarzenegger take on it at least felt a lot more epic. For some reason, this feels a lot smaller scale and there's awfully a lot more CG. It feels like it should be a kind of bigger, wider world that this is set in, but it kind of just doesn't really, because most of it's kind of quite crappy CG or composites. The original film seemed to have a bit more grounding in the fantasy realm. There's a couple of decent fight scenes in here. I think its problem is that there's just too many of them, actually. It doesn't know when to actually stop and have a breath. It just keeps chasing and having horseback chases and sword fights and then more chases and horse fights, and it just keeps going when it could really do with taking a few breaths here and there. If you're going to look for a sensible, cohesive plot, then don't go here. If you like, however, picking holes in things, you'll have a field day with this film. The whole film is predicated on Conan having his entire village slaughtered by a crazed warlord trying to get together all these bits of a mystical mask that will allow him to control the undead and give him like power to conquer the world, which was taken by the barbarian tribes in the past from some other evil necromonger. It was taken and smashed into, what, six pieces or whatever and hidden. But if you're going to smash it into six pieces, why not just smash it completely so this doesn't happen again? So he obviously goes back and gets all these bits of the mask together, and towards the end of the film he gets the complete mask together, which would give him the ultimate power. He puts the mask on and what happens? Conan kicks his ass, because apparently it didn't give him all power. What was the point in that then?
I hope he kept his receipt.
So basically the entire central conceit of the film is total bullshit.
Brilliant.
No, there's not really much to recommend Conan the Barbarian. I've had far worse films. I quite like the initial bits with Ron Perlman, who's doing his usual gruff self, and it makes a bit of sense. But the rest of it, this horrible incestuous subplot with Rose McGowan, and having Rose McGowan's never a good sign in any film. It's the rest of it is just there. It's not absolutely dreadful, but I can't think of any good reason why I'd recommend this to even its target audience of testosterone-addled teenagers. It's just simply not good enough for it.
There you go then. Watch Conan.
No, don't.
Don't watch Conan.
Watch Conan. Watch it.
If every cinema's set up like the one Scott and I saw this in, then if you've got hearing difficulties and can't really enjoy films nowadays, well, this would be good for you, because there's no way you can't hear this. But other than that,
you're guaranteed the next time you go and see, if you go and see it again, there'll be a fresh set of cones in the speakers. Jason Momoa, what a guy. What a stand-up guy. What a goddamn guy.
You've been talking to yourself.
And now I'm talking to David Bowie. Yeah, so apparently the word on the street is that there's this film called One Day. What's that about?
It's about one day in your life. It's about one day in all of our lives. It's about one day. It's about 107 minutes
Is this
long.
That YouTube pish that what's his name put together?
I don't know of the YouTube pish of which you speak. Could you elucidate me?
What's his name? Andrew McDonald, where he asked for people to submit clips of what they were doing on a particular day.
No, right, this, okay. Well, this is, well, apparently our shared ignorance of the world of literature coming to the fore. This is I assume a chick lit piece from a Dave Nichols novel. It is based on two characters, Dexter, in this instance played by Jim Sturgis, and Emma, played by Anne Hathaway, charting their relationship over the course of 20 years by kind of telling the events of what's happening on one day in each of those 20 years, I believe was the conceit of the book. To be honest, in the film, I didn't actually notice any of this happening until well after I kind of read what was going on. So the sense of time passing really wasn't present in the film at all, so take of that what you will. I had no interest whatsoever in seeing this, but as is the case when you're in a relationship, sometimes you have to take one for the team. I was dragged into one day, but I was at least somewhat looking forward to this on the basis of the director, Lone Scherfig, who has directed Wilbur, Who Wants to Kill Himself, and An Education, which were two of the better films of the past decade. So I went in with expectations duly raised, and I was only ever setting myself up for disappointment, come to think of it. The two in this character, Dexter, you know, Dexter annoyingly being shortened to Dex most of the way through the film, which had me grinding my teeth in irritation every time it happened. They meet at Edinburgh University, and this charts the relationship over 28 years or whatever it is, where they do not seem to visibly age one iota, but whatever.
But that'll help the sense of time passing then, won't it? I can see why you were confused.
I haven't aged in 20 years. I use oil of ole twice a day.
I think at some point towards the end, there's some attempt at putting a little bit of grey in Jim Sturgis's hair. But other than that, they all look remarkably similar all the way throughout. Dexter is an overprivileged rich kid who finds fame going all Mockney and presenting what's obviously supposed to be a version of the word. After their university career, he goes off and becomes, you know, a media infant terrible and puts most of his profits directly up his nose and just generally is a dick. Emma goes off to be a bookish writer, at least in theory, although she's more of a waiter in practice. And the two people stumble around just generally not being happy, thinking about their unfulfilled relationship. And they're only ever brought back to, you know, life, as it were, when they're brought back together. And then they go back to living unfulfilled lives and moping around in a mawkish way that makes you want to just shake them. Dexter's career aside, the characters are relatively believable, if somewhat towards the Mills and Boone end of the reality spectrum. But the film's downfall is that the characters are so believable. But believable does not mean the same as interesting. I'm quite interested in my own love life, but I'm not egotistical enough to think that anyone else would be. This film has no such shame, and it's very badly mistaken. Mechanically, it's well put together. I've no qualms with the way it's presented. It's well shot. The acting is good. I've no real complaints with any of that. It's in any way you would judge it from if you were a robot judging a film, you would think this is a perfectly fine film and there's nothing particularly wrong with it. It's well made, but well, it shouldn't have been made. It's just not very interesting. It's just a relationship that I did not care in one slightest from the outset all the way to the end. It's twee in places, the relationship. You just want to kind of shake them, and they're just quite annoying characters all the way throughout, and it does not make you want to root for them in any way. So when they do inevitably get together at the end, I still didn't care, because I haven't cared about them all the way throughout, so I'm not watching a crescendo of a 20-year unfulfilled relationship, or however long it wound up being. I just didn't care more.
Yeah, a lot of what you're saying there, Scott, reminded me quite a bit of a film we saw at the film festival this year called Jack Goes Boating, which seemed to have many of the same problems you're mentioning there. Is that, you know, it's excellent performances, and it was very believable. The relationship was believable. The people interacting were believable, but it just wasn't interesting.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have a film about a relationship, no matter how realistic it is, it's got to have something of interest to people who are not in the relationship.
Yeah.
In this case, the viewer.
Yeah. Character dramas need characters, and this doesn't. It has your blank slates. It seems to be, I'm trying to remember what the term in fan fiction would be, a Mary Sue, I think. It's just sort of something for you to project your own relationship foibles into, rather than have anything of actual depth or interest to say in it of itself. I could sit in front of it, and because it is sort of well made enough, I didn't begrudge sitting in front of it for 90 minutes. Apparently the book in the film is well regarded enough by certain people that I'm sure there must be something in here for some people, but I'm sure it's more projecting their own story into the film rather than anything that is extant in the film itself. I just can't bring myself to care about anyone in here, and I didn't think it was in any way interesting of a character piece. So if you do wander into this film, you're probably going to have to bring your own story with it. And if you have your own batches of unrequited love that you want to think about while you're watching this film, which I suspect is where most people are getting their kicks from, rather than anything that's actually in the film itself, then fair enough. If you want a bit of closure on that aspect, maybe this will help you. But if you just want a decent story, this certainly isn't it.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy by John le Carré. Read by Craig Easton. John le Carré's seminal spy novel Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is now 36 years old, and it's already been the subject of a BBC TV adaptation that many still consider a cornerstone of television drama. Why, then, would Let the Right One In director Thomas Alfredson decide to tackle a big screen adaptation?
Well, maybe it's because he gets to wrangle Gary Oldman, Colin Firth, Tom Hardy, Toby Jones, Mark Strong, Kieran Hines and John Hurt, or as I like to call it, the best all-male cast ever assembled for screen smartass in a stylish, atmospheric and downright engrossing tale of espionage that still proves entertaining today. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong.
You might be mental, but you're not wrong.
I absolutely love Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. My better half fell asleep. That's usually a good sign. That's a sign of quality. It's a sign of quality. I absolutely adore Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's not without its flaws, but my goodness, it's pretty much the best thing I've seen this year.
It is pretty damn good.
Mm. I'd have to agree. Certainly, if it's not the best thing I've seen this year, it's certainly the best thing I've seen in the last 6 months.
Indeed.
I suppose comparisons with the television series is inevitable, but I don't know how relevant they would be for anyone outside of Britain.
Yes. So, I don't know, it's shown in America. Shall we tell our listeners a bit about the plot first, perhaps?
Aye.
Right, so as Craig mentioned, it's an adaptation of the John le Carré novel of the same name, in which aging spy George Smiley is ousted from MI6, referred to in the film as the circus, for being too close to the previous head, Control, who was himself forced out after a covert operation in Hungary goes badly wrong. Sometime after, within the next year or so, Smiley is brought out of his unwilling retirement when information comes to light that a Soviet mole has penetrated the very heart of MI6. Smiley must then spy on the spies and determine which of the four men at the very top is the traitor. And as we've mentioned already, the book was previously adapted for TV by the BBC in 1979 and featured an excellent performance by Alec Guinness as the central character. His role here is played by Gary Oldman, so Oldman's got some big shoes to fill. Now, it's always hard to predict which Gary Oldman you'll get in any given film. And to this end, it's deeply pleasing to note that it's the accomplished thespian Oldman who's turned up here.
Hmm.
You know, the one who, without seemingly doing much, can imbue Lieutenant Gordon with an air of calm authority and trustworthiness, and not, for instance, the scenery-chomping ham as seen in the likes of the Book of Eli. And he's surrounded, too, by, as you mentioned, Craig, an almost uniformly excellent cast, which includes people like Mark Strong, John Hurt, Colin Firth, Kieran Hines, etc. And perhaps only Benedict Cumberbatch is a disappointment. His performance as Peter Gwillem isn't bad. I just feel he's miscast, something though Scott felt as well when we discussed it. It's
yeah, your problem with Benedict Cumberbatch is he looks like he's 12.
Yeah,
I mean, he's actually older than we are.
Yeah, but he looks like he's 12 and therefore completely out of his depth amongst this cast.
So it's perhaps an age thing. It's maybe a bit more than an age thing. It isn't that he's bad, but an age thing primarily, because he doesn't have the character's requisite authority and air of weariness that Michael Jason provided in the same role in the BBC version. And particularly when Tom Hardy's...
Rikita
says some things like, "Yes, sir, Mr. Gwillem." It's like, that's not believable at all.
No, Tom Hardy looks like he'd chew him up and spit him out in this.
Exactly, yeah. Like, direction here comes from Let the Right One In, Helmer Thomas Alfredson, which I feel is a rather inspired choice, as his sombre Scandinavian style is an excellent fit with the grey and beige London of 1973 and the dry, gritty and distinctly unglamorous and unbond-like nature of real-world espionage. And a particular accomplishment here is the pacing. The BBC's slow-burning 7-episode TV adaptation lent itself well to the story's focus on old-fashioned spycraft, character, and the intellectual chess matches that are Smiley's interactions with those he's investigating. And somehow, the combination of Alfredson's direction, Peter Strawn and Bridget O'Connor's screenplay, and Dino Jonsæter's editing has produced a two-hour film that captures that tone and feels very much in a good way, longer than 2 hours. Comparisons to the BBC adaptation are inevitable and justified, I guess, but being particularly enamoured of the Alec Guinness version, I'm very pleased to find that I enjoyed this almost as much. and I have a few issues with it. The revelation of the mole's identity is rather anticlimactic, and a character's motivation in the film's finale is undermined by a piece of dialogue given to Smiley just before. But those small issues are made up for by Mark Strong going slap happy on an owl in a completely mental but deeply entertaining scene. And one scene that differs particularly from the BBC version, in which Smiley recalls his encounter with Soviet spymaster Karla, which is actually an improvement. It's an excellent cerebral thriller, and I would highly recommend anyone to watch it. Say, if you must compare, it's not quite as good as the BBC version, but I think given how much rubbish there is in the world, there's plenty of room in it for two such excellent productions to coexist.
Well, most definitely, especially 30 years apart.
Indeed.
You know, that's enough time to be remaking something, I suppose. And you could argue this isn't a remake because it was...
It's just another adaptation.
Yeah, a different medium. Yeah, exactly. I absolutely love this. I think there's a bit of a game of smoke and mirrors going on in everybody's part in this, because actually when you sit down and look at it, the so-called investigation into the identity of the mole isn't really that much of an investigation. And I felt like the constant jumps in narrative back and forward in time between the original revelation of the mole, the presence of a mole, while Control was still in charge of MI6, and the latter-day investigation were really there to... I felt like the filmmakers were trying to convince me that actually things were more complex than they actually were. But that aside, you mentioned the Gary Oldman which turns up in this film. The Gary Oldman that turns up in this film is a Gary Oldman I haven't seen before, because it's the best Gary Oldman I've ever seen. And if I've ever seen someone...
No, it's the best I've ever seen, yeah, as well. Yeah.
If ever I've seen someone do justice to a character, he's up there with people who I can't even think of right now, because that kind of performance is so rare that you don't get to talk about it very often.
It's quite rare to see such a good performance where so much relies on doing so little.
Well, yeah, a lot of it relies on doing nothing. Like the
which
scene
is a really hard thing to pull off, and it's particularly surprising it's Gary Oldman that did it.
Mm.
I refer you to the Book of Eli.
There's a brilliant
scene.
Not
too strongly, because it's terrible.
Brilliant scene at the very start of the film that tells you everything you need to know about George Smiley, which I believe also is the scene that Gary Oldman mentioned gave him a sort of window into the character, which is where we see from an outside view the back of the car as he's been driven back to MI6, and the two guys in front of the car are chatting away and sort of being harassed by a wasp or something, a bee, which I think a bee actually, isn't it? Which is
a bee, because the guy's a beekeeper.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
trapped
in the car with him, and while they're flapping about, the sort of bee comes at the back of the car, and George Smiley sort of calmly follows it, rolls down the window, and lets it out. That's the kind, yeah. That's the kind of man he is.
I don't want to derail you, but just been talking about doing very little too. I think for the first 5 or 6 minutes that you see George Smiley on screen, he doesn't say a word. He does everything with just subtle looks. And
it's something ridiculous, like 15 things. Minutes before he speaks.
Yeah, there's a while in, man.
Yeah.
When he's getting sacked, he's sort of looks kind of hurt, but I'm resigned, and then he's looking at control as he leaves the building.
In fact, he's not even really sacked. He's just told, you're coming with me, by someone else who's being sacked. That's all it takes in the world of espionage. It's funny, actually, because I recently went back and watched the Ipcress File and Funeral in Berlin to see Michael Caine sort of portraying a sort of an anti-Bond and what was considered then a much more sort of down-to-earth portrayal of what the spy game might be like. And if Harry Palmer was the anti-Bond, then I guess George Smiley is the anti-Harry Palmer.
He's anti-Bond on sedatives.
He's some next-level do-nothing shit. It's a hugely understated performance, but in the kind of way that makes the performance actually incredibly massive and incredibly restrained. And if anything, between that and the production design, the look of the film's absolutely fantastic. Everything feels absolutely spot-on and authentic in this. The haircuts, that's the easy thing. But when you're sort of being taken on, you know, a little tour of around the inside of MI6 in this completely nondescript building, and you get upstairs and you see what a 1973 version of a soundproofed conference room is, which
is basically a workman's porta cabin.
Yeah, basically a porta cabin on stilts lined with like orange egg cartons. Everything just fits absolutely perfectly. And the mood and the atmosphere of it, I just thought absolutely brilliant. It's up there in the sort of pantheon of spy and sort of espionage films along the lines of, I guess, The Day of the Jackal and things like that for me. I absolutely loved it. I can't wait to watch again. It's the only film I've seen in the last, I can't even remember. It's got to be sort of 3 or 4 years since I last saw a film that I wished was a good hour longer, because the one criminal thing about it is that you've got this unbelievable cast, and the only people who get to do anything really are Gary Oldman and Mark Strong. And they're probably the two guys who I wanted to see doing stuff, to be honest, out of the cast. But when you've got all these other guys at your disposal, and especially Toby Jones and Kieran Hines have about 10 lines between them in the entire film. Mm. And I would love to see an extra hour, an extra 2 hours of this film in some sort of edit, but I don't know if it would be the same film then. I don't know. I just can't say enough about it. Absolutely loved it.
I guess the thing with making it longer is I actually prefer this to the television series. It somehow has everything that was even slightly of interest in the television series in a much shorter space of time, and doesn't actually seem to cut anything out, because even in the television series, even though it's about twice as long, the character of Roy Bland and Percy Alline really don't get anything to say or do that is of any note in that, as they do here. So I don't feel that I've actually had anything, I'm not missing anything from this adaptation. I seem to have got all the points that made the television series good in this. And even though it is a much shorter film, it still felt like it had the same kind of slow burn to revelation. So it really hits all the same high points and has basically just cuts out a lot of fat, which is a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
It cuts out a lot of fat, but at the same time, I can't help but think that if anyone else were in that role, or if Gary Oldman had done less of a job than he does of that central role, I think things would swiftly unravel, because his performance aside, his performance kind of detracts you from the point that this is supposed to be some sort of labyrinthine mole hunt, and that these guys, any one of these five guys, could actually be this Russian spy who's been embedded in MI6 for like the past 30 years. But when it gets down to it, we don't get to spend any time with any of those other characters, and you have no clue who they are, you have no clue really what they've done, you have no clue what their motives might be. So really, when that's laid out in front of you, there's no way for you as an audience to really even begin to suggest to yourself, oh, I think it might be him. I think it might be him, because they don't.
But you can say the same about Smiley. I mean, apart from the fact that you're kind of introduced to him as the sympathetic character, he's as equally as valid a choice as any others for picking it.
Well,
even
exactly.
Even when it gets to the end and there is the revelation of who it is, it's so massively unsatisfying as to any kind of rational explanation that it might as well have been anyone. You could have picked it from a hat. And it would have made as much sense, because there isn't really any real sound motivation behind most of this.
No, but there's, it's not just that the character in the end doesn't seem to have that much motivation. It's just that there's no setup for any of the characters to suggest. There's just no setup for any of the characters. You get sort of a brief idea of who these characters are, but there's nothing to make you suspect one over the other, or really have any idea of what motives they might have or anything like that. And in that sense, actually, the more I think about it, the more it completely fails. But at the same time, the fact that I enjoyed it so much is testament to just how fantastic a piece of filmmaking it is, if not actually technically that much of a detective story.
Detective story is the framework for it, but it doesn't seem, it's not actually the point of the film.
No.
The point of the film is George Smiley.
Yeah.
Just sort of going about his business in the kind of the way that he does things, and the way that Le Carre, I believe he has some experience of the spy world, and it's shows a bit more of the actual mechanics of this sort of business rather than the glorified nonsense that you get in Hollywood films. So in that respect, it's not the most engaging investigation.
It's not the most thrilling there who's done it.
The investigation's only there to serve as the character pieces, and it's the characters that make this the most interesting aspect of the film. And that's why everyone likes it so much.
If Gary Oldman isn't up for every award going this year, then I'm going to go on the rampage with
what I was thinking. If there was any justice, then, I mean, certainly the best supporting actor would be taken entirely. It would be listed entirely from this film.
Yeah.
There's certainly nothing else that I've seen this year that touches it.
It'll be why World War III inevitably kicks off.
If I'm picking flaws with it, only two things are. I don't think that it's particularly well explained as to why the mole actually does what he does. And
it's not even well explained, it's just not explained. It seems completely on a whim.
I think I said to Drew that maybe the whole concept of that made more sense back when this was written in the 70s, and you could just get it from the kind of ideological struggles that were going at the time, but I don't think it works for a modern audience. It certainly didn't work for me.
Why did you choose to become a Russian mole? I had nothing better to do that day, effectively.
It seemed like a laugh.
Shits and giggles.
I ticked the wrong box on the form.
Stuck with it now.
That's it. Bummer.
Cumberbatch, good, but miscast. I just think you need someone with a bit more meat to him to play the role.
Yeah.
And the thing that I couldn't quite puzzle out is why the pronunciation of Toby Esterhazy changed to Easterhouse at some point between the 70s and now. I don't know why that's interesting or important. It just I just changed it for the
hell of it. I still haven't watched the TV series, so I can't comment.
Minor quibbles aside, best film I've seen this half of the year at least, and probably the best film I've seen this year. Run out, see it.
If Gary Oldman lets, I know we don't consider them a particularly worthy indicator, but if I were a betting man, I'd go down to the bookies now, because if Gary Oldman doesn't win Best Actor at the Oscars this year, I will eat, what would you like me to eat?
The Academy members that didn't vote for him.
Something practical that I have to hand. I'm being deadly serious. I'll eat an inanimate object.
Well, no, because I don't want to make you unnecessarily suffer, and you will have to, because they probably won't pick him, because that's why nine of the three of us are interested in Oscar. But they've never picked the right people.
But it's so obvious this year.
It's been so obvious in other years as well, and it's still not happened.
Well, but I'll eat my iPhone case. There you go.
How about a nice steak?
That's a video podcast for you. Yes, I'll eat a nice steak. So come, what will it be? January, February?
See, that way, even if it's a disappointment, it's still a cause for celebration, you know?
Exactly. A nice medium rare fillet steak with peppercorn sauce and all the trimmings. Maybe some roast potatoes, maybe some asparagus. Some mushroom or something. I don't know, maybe.
You see, we're looking forward to it already.
God, I hope Gary...
You don't want him to win now, do you?
I hope Gary doesn't win. But, man, what a film. What a film. And it's the only thing, actually, that... I mean, I'm sure he's a stand-up guy, and as much as I enjoyed The King's Speech as a film, it's the first time I've felt even really slightly engaged with Colin Firth as an actor. There you go. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy has given me so much. So much. Yeah, can't praise it highly enough. I think we've covered all bases, haven't we?
I believe so,
yes.
Yes. Well, there you go. Thank you for bearing with us for another podcast. What number are we up to now? We're in the mid-80s, aren't we?
84.
Podcast number 84. I can feel that centenary coming. I can feel it coming. Yeah, listen, thanks for bearing with us for another podcast. We hope we've given you some insight. If not, then you're a dick. I, as always, have been Craig. Drew was Drew.
I was.
And Scott was reputedly Scott.
Well, goodbye.
There we are. We'll see you again soon enough, I gather, probably sooner than the interval between our last two podcasts. So, yeah, take care in the meantime, and we'll speak to you soon.
Cheerio.
Oh, and don't forget to email us, podcast@theoneliner.com. Bye!
Conan, IMDb. Did you know? Goofs. Anachronisms. Just after blah, 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 blah. Why doesn't it just say all of it?
Yeah. Also, what do you mean, anachronisms? It's not a place or time that ever existed.
Yes. Becomes somewhat exempt from that, then.